It's really just taking these basic ideas of open protocols, distributed and decentralized networks, and applying it not just to sharing data and information, but to sharing value in a way where you don't have to trust a centralized, single centralized institution to facilitate that. And so it really seemed clear to me that this could be as significant of a technical shift as the web was 20 years ago, and I wanted to build a company around that, and build a company not just around that particular technology, but more broadly, what would this do to existing categories in different industries? So within the finance industry, what would this do to retail finance? What would this do to consumer finance? What becomes possible? What does the world look like?
Barefoot Innovation starts right now.
Welcome to our first Barefoot Innovation episode focused on Bitcoin. I often talk about the five technology trends that are revolutionizing financial services. Number four on my list is digital currency and the blockchain. I'm excited that my guest today is one of the most thoughtful people anywhere on this topic and on payments in general. It's Jeremy Allaire, the founder and CEO of Circle, a startup that's setting out to transform financial services through instant and almost free movement of money. Not long ago, even senior leaders in banks and regulatory agencies were dismissing Bitcoin as insignificant and weird at best and dangerous at worst. Today, a lot of people still think it's weird and dangerous, but no one thinks it's not important. I'm going to assume that our listeners know the basics of this, that Bitcoin invented the blockchain, which is an open distributed ledger of transactions visible on the internet, and that being on the internet makes it, like everything else there, instant and free. I think most people also know that this can transform our slow, expensive payment system, and really any system that is in effect a chain of transactions or records. Most people know the blockchain record is unfakeable and unbreakable, and again, it's visible. Attributes that can fundamentally change how we organize things, from money and contracts and legal titles to operating systems and markets of all kinds. I once wrote a blog post called "The Benefits of Bitcoin" and argued that the cheap and instant movement of money offers huge upside potential for financial consumers as well as new risks. Think about all the problems that consumers have now that are centered on the slow, expensive, difficult process of moving money, and how lags in crediting payments fuel the need for everything from payday lending to overdrafts. As understanding of Bitcoin has spread, a new conventional wisdom has been emerging that the crucial innovation here is not digital currency, but rather the blockchain itself, including the use of closed blockchains that are inside companies and closed networks. In our conversation, Jeremy challenges that idea head on. He argues passionately that the big power here is in the openness of the technology. In our show notes, we'll link to an article he wrote last November in Recode, reminding us that the openness of the internet used to scare people too, and that its nature as an open, decentralized platform on which everyone can innovate is what brought us the transformative system that we have now. He also talks about the crucial point that these networks can create trustable systems without our actually having to know and trust the other parties in them, which is part of what gives them so much power. Bringing that logic into payments is the mission of Circle. As I say in my conversation with him, I'm a Circle customer myself. I'm constantly amazed by it. So as we have our talk in this episode, Jeremy explains how Circle works, their business model and plans, his own long background in technology, the vision for where Circle is headed and where the system is headed, and also his thoughts about regulation of finance and fintech. He has a real gift for discussing mind-bending tech changes in ways that everyone can understand. and also in ways that really provoke thought about the future. This is without a doubt one of the most fascinating episodes we've ever done. At the end of it, keep listening for a very different message from me. And now, enjoy my conversation with Circle's Jeremy Allaire. I'm so pleased today to welcome my guest, Jeremy Allaire, the co-founder and CEO of Circle. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Joanne. Really a pleasure.
I am really excited to be talking with you. You were nice enough to come and talk to my Harvard study group, and I will tell you, you were a huge hit there.
Oh, good.
Everyone loved it, and I've had lots of follow-up from it. And today we're in your offices in Boston, in a sort of quintessential startup space, very wonderful here amidst the brick and the warehouse ceilings and so on.
It's great.
In the Innovation District. So we have had a lot of podcasts where we've talked about Bitcoin and digital currency and the blockchain, but you are the first guest we've had who is fully immersed in that space as part of your business model.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really interested in getting your perspective on where we may be headed with these new payment systems in general.
Mm-hmm.
But let me start by asking you to talk a little bit about yourself, the journey, what you've done, what brought you to this point.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. So, you know, a lot of people have asked me sort of, why did you start Circle, or, you know, how is it sort of an evolution of kind of who you are? And for me, it's really, it's sort of the outgrowth of a lot of things that I've been interested in for over 20 years. And, you know, just by way of background, my original background was studying kind of international political economy. So I was really interested in how the international economic system worked, comparative economic systems, international monetary policy, things like that. And that was academic interest, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1990, I sort of discovered the internet. I didn't discover the internet. But I discovered it personally. I found out about it. And you know, back then there was really nothing there. It was an academic network. There were some government institutions that were part of it. But what really inspired me was that it was a distributed and decentralized network that, you know, anyone could join. Anyone could add a computer to this, and anything you could do with software, you could do globally. And that, you know, in my mind at the time, this was in the early 90s, was, hey, this is where the future of communications is going to be. This is how information sharing is going to happen. This is how media is going to get distributed. And got really excited about those transformations, the potential of meaningful disruption in how media and information and communication happened. And back even in college, I was, you know, sort of hacking different things, like hacking different news feeds and sources of data on the internet and aggregating them into, you know, presentable interfaces to people. This is before the web existed.
Where were you at college?
I was at McAllister College,
mm-hmm.
You know, studying political science, philosophy, and economics. And
love it.
Yeah, and you know, and that sort of captured my imagination, and I sort of made it a big part of my academic interests and my personal and professional interests ultimately. And so when I graduated college in 1993, you know, my liberal arts degrees weren't that useful in and of themselves. I think they've proven to be really useful for me over the long run. But
I'd actually like to circle back on that point. Oh,
yeah.
Sorry, I can't ever talk about Circle without constantly making puns. But
circle back, yeah.
Sorry about that. Go ahead.
It happens a lot. And so I, in 1993, graduated, and in late 1993, in the fall, the first kind of real web browser came out. And that was a new piece of software that ran over computers connected to the internet. And that was like what I call one of the big aha moments for me. I was already super knowledgeable and passionate about the internet, but this was sort of the missing piece. This was a friendly layer that you could put in front of this complex distributed network. But what was really inspiring for me was it was this idea of an open network that anyone could publish information into. Mm-hmm. If you had a web server, you could create content, and anyone in the world who's connected to this network could use it. It was very democratizing and very powerful. And so I ended up kind of committing my professional life to work on ideas around that, and helped as one of the early founders in a software company that was really around those ideas. How do you, if you have $1,000 in an idea, you should be able to build a global online service and make that work for anyone in the world. And we ended up building a really great software business and a public company, a global public company, that then we sold to a bigger internet software company, Macromedia, which most people know of because they've used Flash Player, which was one of the key products. And that actually led me into my next sort of journey, which was we put video technology into Flash in 2002, so I don't know, 14 years ago almost. Mm-hmm. And that was really powerful because every computer in the world had Flash. And so it meant that, you know, with broadband growing, within a year or two, everyone in the world would be able to watch video over the internet in a seamless way, in a way that really worked for people. And so I kind of, that was another aha moment where I said, you know what, the way that television works and the way that video works is going to be completely turned upside down. And it's going to be by building on open protocols and building on open networks for how information gets shared, in this case, video. And my thought was, over the long run, the traditional closed networks, cable companies, satellite companies, traditional broadcast, would get disrupted by the open internet. And I wanted to build a platform to help do that. Mm-hmm. So that was a company I started called Brightcove. I left Macromedia, started that company, built that, and I'm still involved with that company. And that has grown to be another big public company, or good-sized public company. But what was interesting about the theme, and it relates now to Circle, which is I'm really interested in how open technologies, decentralized technologies, open protocols can work on a global basis and sort of change the world. And so in summer and fall of 2012, I started to become really interested in digital currency and Bitcoin. And I learned about it and was fascinated.
That was the day before yesterday.
It's not that long ago. Yeah. And it was, a kind of aha moment. Yeah. The way I put it is, you know, I said, I have to understand how this works, because my first reaction was, this just doesn't even seem plausible or possible. But obviously, I have enough of a technical background to kind of understand and evaluate these things, and it was incredibly exciting what I saw. And I downloaded my first digital wallet, I synchronized the blockchain, and I was a node on the network, and I started sending and receiving transactions to different addresses, and it was a huge aha moment for me, which really, that the immediate insight was, this is like the birth of the web, but this is the birth of the value web, as some people like to call it, or it's the internet of value exchange. And it's really just taking these basic ideas of open protocols, distributed and decentralized networks, and applying it not just to sharing data and information, but to sharing value in a way where you don't have to trust a single centralized institution to facilitate that. And so it really seemed clear to me that this could be as significant of a technical shift as the web was 20 years ago, and I wanted to build a company around that, and build a company not just around that particular technology, but more broadly, what would this do to existing categories in different industries? So within the finance industry, what would this do to retail finance? What would this do to consumer finance? What becomes possible? What does the world look like? And that's where Sean and I, who co-founded the company with me, really started to aim our interest. And so that's sort of how we got here.
So this is so great. So I think you know our series is a search for better solutions for financial consumers through technology and through better regulation and other things. So why don't we pick up where you just were? How is this going to change all those categories of finance? What's your vision?
Yeah, you know, I think maybe at a macro level, before drilling into, say, consumer finance, I'll keep this very short because I know that's the subject, but really people need to think of this network, the Bitcoin network, the Bitcoin blockchain, as a secure, extremely secure kind of trust ledger. It's something that can be used to verify and authenticate a lot of types of information and to exchange title to things, whether that's, you know, a currency you have, it could be a property you own, it could be an equity that you're trading, it could be your identity, it could be many things. But it's at the foundation, it's this incredibly powerful, secure computing network that allows people to conduct transactions directly over the internet without having to trust some intermediary. And that's really powerful. And so building on that, one of the first use cases of this technology is the movement of currency value. And there are lots of other experiments and ideas for how to use this for the movement of other types of value. Property title is one example. Equities is another example. There's many, many along that list. But so we were really interested in what that would mean for how people move currency value. And the conclusion we kind of reached was that if you look at the way the internet evolved over the past 20 years, there's a whole bunch of things because of these kinds of similar kinds of architecture, similar kinds of technologies. We now have the ability to, for example, communicate freely with anyone in the world using text, audio, video. We have free global communications as consumers, yeah. And that's pretty amazing. 20 years ago, no one would have thought that was possible. We have the ability to search all the knowledge of the world for free. That's pretty powerful. We have the ability to publish any kind of content basically for free as well. We can publish you can publish this on SoundCloud and you're not going to get charged for that, and yeah. And you can publish videos and share photos and content and other things. So we can publish free, we can find information, we can do all these things. And I think the same kind of forces that have that happen to communications and media is going to happen to payments. And so I think what that, over the long run, and these things take a lot longer than most people generally think. You can make these assertions, but they really take 10 or 20 years to really unfold. So we don't look at this as like, oh, next year there will no longer be any fees for payments, right? That's mm-hmm. not realistic. But mm-hmm. over the long run, we think that the storage of value and the kind of transmission of value or the movement of value between storage locations, that's just going to be a free service on the internet. And you won't have to pay anything to anyone to be able to move value. When you send $100 to someone, whether it's a business or a consumer, whether it's in the US or in another part of the world, a whole $100 will get there. There's not going to be a percent or two or anything taken from the top. That in the same way we can do that with other kinds of data on the internet, we're going to be able to do that with the movement of value. And so one starting premise is we think we can make how people exchange value free and make that work anywhere in the world where people have a mobile phone. And instant, nearly instant, and more secure than we have to date, and more private as well. So that's part of the more secure piece is sort of, helping with privacy. And do that in a way which is globally interoperable in the same way that HTTP made information globally interoperable. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of a starting point is that there are a lot of business models that exist around extracting a toll for facilitating an electronic payment, and we think those are going to be more and more challenging to defend over time. And that includes moving between currencies, not within one currency as well. So that's a big shift that we think will take place over yeah. time.
So I'm a Circle customer, as you know, and I always like to tell people this, and I always usually get quite the oh wow reaction to it, that I can hold money in my Circle account mm-hmm. now in dollars.
Yes.
I used to have to hold it in Bitcoin, but right. now I can hold it in dollars, FDIC insured.
Yeah.
My daughter was living in Europe. I could send her money to her Circle account.
Yeah.
She would have it a few seconds later.
Yeah.
It was free.
Yeah.
She could take it out in whichever currency she wanted.
Right.
And we were, again, bypassing the entire
right.
infrastructure of wiring and fees
yeah.
and
yeah.
remittance. And
it's pretty powerful stuff. When you first experience it.
Yeah, yeah. it's yeah. amazing. So let's talk a little. Describe mm-hmm. Circle.
Yeah, sure. So I mean, this is really important, which is that when we think about who we are as a company, when we founded the company, and you can see this in the product itself, you can see this in the brand and what we represent and how we position what we do, but we think of ourselves as an internet-based consumer finance company or an internet finance company. We definitely don't think of ourselves as a digital currency company or a Bitcoin company any more than Amazon, when they started, would have called themselves an HTTP company. They were a retailer, a book retailer, that happened to use a disruptive technology to make it more efficient to distribute goods, for mm-hmm. example. So it's, for us, technology like Bitcoin or the blockchain are enabling technologies. We think they're really powerful. We want to use them in part because there's a global network effect that's happening. There's a lot of intellectual property and products and services and capital that's sort of being built around this. And we all gain from those global network effects. So it's an important enabling technology. But nonetheless, today, Circle provides, you know, an app and a service that allows you to, you know, send and receive personal payments as a free service. And you can do that by sending through an app. You can send money straight from your debit card or bank account. You can send it and transmit it to other Circle users. And then you can transmit payments also through the Bitcoin network globally. And you can send those payments to a phone number, an email address. You can do it in person with a QR code. You know, it's a variety of means to do that. And we've tried to build something where the experience of exchanging value or sharing value is more similar to the experiences that we have, for example, sharing ideas or content, messages, photos. What are the important consumer behaviors that are driving how people interact with data and information online, and trying to weld those together? And so the Circle app experience is more akin to what people sometimes would think of as like a social messaging app experience than it is a next gen view of what a bank looks like, because that's not what we're going after. We think that this whole category as well, personal payments, is a much, much bigger category than anyone has thought to date. We think it is, you know, the amount of personal payments that happen in the U.S. alone, just with cash and checks and some electronic means, it's almost $1 trillion a year. It's an enormous amount. And most of it's still analog and offline. And so there's a huge opportunity to create these kinds of services, but not just that work in one country, but that work all around the world. Mm-hmm. So that's really the focus today, is just making those kinds of personal payments, you know, easier, more fun, etc.
Mm-hmm. And you also, I should say, you recently raised, I believe, a $50 million capital round, and Goldman Sachs.
That's right.
Led that,
yeah.
Which I think is partly a testament to the seriousness of what you're doing. People hear the word Bitcoin and they tend to go off into the, the imaginative realm.
Well, it's become fashionable, of course, for people within the financial industry or the media or the press or business press or government to talk about Bitcoin but just not say the word. So they say blockchain instead, because it's sort of somehow a less scary thing to say. But they're actually talking about Bitcoin.
So Jeremy,
or they're talking about the ideas that inform Bitcoin, but they won't say the word.
Yeah,
so I wrote an editorial recently about this.
So I was just going to say that. You had a great article in MeCode, which we will link to in our show notes for this episode. But I would love you to talk some more about that, because it was really a clarifying thought process. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the article is a little long, so I won't go through all of the premise. But the basic premise is that I think a lot of people want to have all of the benefits of Bitcoin: instant settlement, global interoperability, really secure, you know, etc. But they want it without Bitcoin. And that's not really how this actually works. You know, the whole benefit, and I use really these other internet platforms as corollaries. You know, who controls email? No one, right? Who controls the web? No one. It's open intellectual property. People contribute to this, and it's changed the world. And I think a open, distributed, decentralized system for value exchange is really quite similarly powerful. And it actually, the breakthrough is that you can have such a secure system without you know, worrying about the corruptibility of you know, the participants, and it allows it to be global as well. So there are many facets to it which I think are really unique. The idea of applying similar technology, or creating similar technology, distributed ledgers that synchronize amongst participants, and applying that to kind of back office processes in finance or other fields, it's a fine idea. There's nothing wrong with that idea. It's just not that revolutionary. It's not going to change the world. It might improve the back office of some banks or accounting firms or whatever, but it's not going to change the world. So an open network that's global, that has the same kind of access and openness as email and the web and so many other things, that'll change the world. And so that's interesting. If someone has a better idea for how to build a global, open, distributed network for transaction validation and so forth, and they could make it more secure than this network, we'll happily look at that. But to date, no one has, and I don't see anything on the horizon right now that could come close.
When you spoke to my student group at Harvard, one of the things you said was, if you want to send an email to someone in Denmark, or I've forgotten what you said,
yeah.
Go ahead. And
yeah, I mean, email's a great example, and most, the average consumer doesn't, they don't know how internet email works or how the web works or any of these things, but it's right. It's useful to actually understand that, to understand what something like Bitcoin can do. So if I want to send an email, and let's say I use Gmail and you use Gmail, let's start with the simple example. If I send an email to you and you're on Gmail, well, the email actually never goes over the internet. It's never formatted and sent through the internet, open internet mail network. It's just an update in the Google database, and you each see that, you know, that information was exchanged. It's sort of it's in that closed system. But if I want to send an email and I use Gmail and I want to send you an email, let's say you're in Japan and you use NTT Docomo as your ISP and you use their email or whatever, well, that just works. I could send that email and it just gets to that other recipient, and all you needed is an address. And it gets you know, routed over the public internet, over a decentralized and distributed network that no one controls. But we agree on the protocols. We agree on how it will work, and that's what makes it fly. And so, you know, a network like the Bitcoin network is very conceptually very similar. If I want to send value to an address, I can do it within a financial institution, in which case it's just a ledger update. Or I can do it over the open internet, and the other end needs to support that protocol, and they'll do with that value whatever one would do. If it's in Japan, they'll instantly convert it into yen, and you have, you know, essentially cross currencies through the Bitcoin network, and you've enabled that transaction to settle nearly instantly and very securely, and so on. And so, the adoption of this as a network and a set of protocols, kind of. I think is similar to how we had these open protocols emerge for communications and for information sharing. The same with, like, when you type in an address to look at a website, and the website's in China or the website's in India or wherever, right? Your web browser maker didn't have to go do a deal with the internet service provider in that country to make that work. The person who created the website and put that content on the web server didn't have to do a deal with anyone. It's an open contract. Any computer in the world can access that information. We want the same thing to work for value, not just currency value, but other forms of value over time too.
Mm-hmm. And when we think about the fact that this is converging with the near ubiquity of mobile smartphones in the world,
mm-hmm.
even among very low-income people,
yeah,
the unlocking of power in that is mind-boggling.
It's really, really powerful when you think about it. If there's a way where effectively any person with a smartphone can have the equivalent of a digital bank account and can instantly move value securely in and out of that anywhere in the world, that's really powerful. I think it'll empower a lot of people. And then when you can kind of take that to the next level, you know, when you think about the developing world and consumers in the developing world, where there aren't mature banking systems in many cases, people don't have access to credit. People don't even, in many cases, have title on their property. They don't have assets that a financial institution could value. Blockchain technology can change all of that. You can use blockchain technology to certify ownership of a property, for example. And if there's a way to have a digital certificate of my home in India, and I can register that on the blockchain, well, then, and as long as it's cryptographically verifiable, and that's the power of having this really secure ledger of the Bitcoin blockchain, I could then receive credit against my asset from anywhere in the world, conceivably, and then use that for, developing a business or supporting a family or whatever it is. And so I think it financial inclusion is not just, hey, giving people bank accounts. It's actually creating an open global system that everyone can participate in. Hmm.
So talk a little bit more about the security. As you know, there's sort of a stereotype around certainly Bitcoin itself that it's had connections to misuse.
That's because it's so secure. Yeah. I'm serious.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's an irreversible payment type that is very secure and very private. And so that's useful. It's useful to a lot of people. If I'm a business, I want very secure, verifiable private transactions, you know, if I'm a consumer paying a retailer, I want my financial privacy and I want my transaction to be secure, etc. And so those are features, not bugs. Absolutely, because of the open nature of this, just like the open nature of the internet, you know, terrorists use Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, and it's right there in the public, right? These are open platforms, and we have to struggle with that. Obviously, openness is something we really cherish, and that privacy and personal freedom is something we really, really cherish. And so I think the key thing here is, and there are a lot of different pieces to this, there's the sort of the security of the network. The network is very secure. No one's ever, either on a theoretical basis or an actual basis, challenged the security of the network. But making it really a simple customer experience, so you don't have to think about all that, is a harder part. That's part of what we've tried to do, is sort of hide the complexity. I don't have to know what a private key is or a public key or a cryptographic hash or any of this stuff, blockchain. It's just in the background, just like you don't know about SMTP and POP and MIME headers and stuff that goes on an email.
Right.
So I think you have to obscure the complexity to get the benefits of it. And you know, for people who are really advanced and want to be their own bank and control their own assets in a digital form and can have the security of that, they should be able to do that. And they are. And that's powerful, too. But I think, anyway, I don't know if that addressed some of it.
Yeah. So is it fair to say that the key to the security, or part of it, is that the blockchain is transparent and visible to everybody on the internet, and therefore you can't really... You can't duplicate it, you can't...
Yeah,
you can't.
It's tamper-proof,
yeah.
And it is irreversible, and those are really powerful attributes. You can't counterfeit a Bitcoin, you can't fake a payment, you can't spoof an address. These are things that...
You can't do the equivalent of cutting a check.
You can't, that's right. And so they're not promises. It's one of the things about these digital tokens, and that's really all that Bitcoin is. It's just a kind of, it's just a slot on a ledger.
Mm-hmm.
You don't actually have any Bitcoin. You just have a security key that allows you to control an address or move tokens from one address to another address. Mm-hmm. Those tokens, I forget exactly where I was.
You were talking about that it's secure,
yeah,
because it's can't be duplicated, and it.
That's right. They're you know, it's a tamper-proof kind of transaction. It can't be counterfeited,
right,
etc.
Right.
Those are overall good attributes. It doesn't mean you can't create other things around it. For example, there are mechanisms in Bitcoin to allow for refunds or things like that. There are lots of things that are going to be built around this technology to deal with things like identity, to deal with things like reputation, to deal with things like refund flows. Built into the Bitcoin technology and into the software and the protocols are a very simple kind of scripting language that allows you to build kind of also tamper-proof kind of business logic. So you could sort of say, the customer sent the funds, the merchant sent the goods. Once the goods are received, the funds are released. So multiple signatures, escrow methods, all these kinds of things that would allow for dispute mediation, other common kinds of practices that are used in e-commerce and other commerce. You can accomplish all those things right in the technology today. You just have to build it.
And the fact that it has virtually no cost other than the business costs around it also means people can transmit tiny amounts of money.
Yeah.
Which is another...
Yeah.
It seems like that in turn could change business models.
Yeah, I mean, I think all this... Absolutely. I like to, just for fun, you know, send a message and a photo or whatever with 2 cents to people, yeah. You know, and have a little back and forth. And that's, you can do that. There's no cost to really do that for us. Mm-hmm. I think the people are I think, have a pretty narrow view of how money gets used. And I think once it goes all digital and you have the creativity of software and you have the richness of expression that you have in apps on these new computing devices we all carry around, I think we're going to have a lot of reinvention of our experience of money. What is the UX of money? And we're going to have a lot of reinvention around the use cases. You know, micropayment acknowledgements for, you know, gameplay in an online game that are fractions of a penny that are just accumulating. Just be something that was just never possible before. Or tipping content creators and artists with micropayments. It's just never possible before. There are many, many other things. But, you know, we're really talking about eliminating a lot of friction and cost and complexity that exists with the existing way that money works, and that'll open up a lot of creative horizons. And we're barely at the, you know, barely at the first inning on that kind of stuff.
Definitely. Yeah. So do you have a thought on how this will evolve? You said there's going to be a long, long timeline here. We know that globally and certainly in the United States, we have a payment system that's rooted in old technology and is slow and expensive. The people who are running the payment systems and the people who run central banks, everybody's paying attention to the potential here to change, you know, the official as well as the unofficial systems. I mean, what's your guess as to how this might unfold in terms of the reform of the traditional systems and or the bypassing of them?
You know, we spent a reasonable amount of time talking with existing financial institutions, payment networks, government, central banks, etc. And I think it's right. Everyone's interested in all this and trying to figure out how can this apply. I think we don't really know how it's all going to evolve. I think back again to the early days of the commercial internet, and there were a lot of ideas for how this would evolve, but we just couldn't predict most of it. We just couldn't predict most of it. So I don't know exactly, but what I would say is I think we'll see a continued movement amongst central banks to look at how they can use cryptocurrency as a basis for the full digitization of their fiat currencies. And because there are a lot of potential benefits to using cryptocurrency as both settlement platforms, as for security and privacy reasons, for auditability, you know, for example, you know, Basel III, you know, has these kind of leverage guidelines, and it's all around how financial institutions represent different types of assets and how those assets bubble up on their balance sheet and how much risk there is in the financial system, which is all based on what happened, you know, 5 years ago or whatever, 6 years, I don't know what it is. I think technology like cryptocurrency can make financial institutions that interact with central bank money a lot more accountable. You can do cryptographic audits, so you could have essentially every type of asset in a financial institution as a crypto asset, and you could immediately sort of see the security and integrity of a financial institution through a cryptographic audit, which is would change bank examination. It would change a lot of things. I think it would have a potentially a meaningful impact on how monetary policy is guided, and this is something that the Central Bank of England has made a number of comments about, which is digital currency has the potential for the central bank to have a much more direct impact on money velocity and on you know, kind of the issue, the use of funds in an economy. So a lot of really powerful things that are possible. So I think we'll see central bank money in a digital form in cryptographic currencies. But I think it's interesting is, you know, this isn't a battle of, you know, Bitcoin versus the dollar, or the dollar versus the euro, or the euro versus the yuan, and that all is interesting chatter. I'm interested in global platforms. I'd like to see this work globally and not just be one nation. Every nation have its own thing. I'd like to see something work globally. So over the very long term, it would be interesting to see how kind of open global platforms could interact with these country-specific, cryptocurrencies and kind of make that work for everyone.
I think I might have told you my daughter just got her master's degree at the London School of Economics, and she wrote her dissertation on the European Union's regulatory response to digital currency. Mm. It's a very interesting, fast-evolving story. No, really.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and I think a lot of people. Maybe a couple of years ago in those kinds of institutions would have been very, very dismissive because I met with a lot of them. It was a big part of what we sought out to do is to just engage and educate the market. I think people are realizing, hey, there's actually something really profound here and we got to figure it out. Let's embrace it and figure out the ways to get the benefits of it. Let's figure out the ways to address the risks. And, Circle has been very clear and open about the fact that we think certain classes of businesses that interact with this should have regulatory structures around them, and we're not just for our digital currency activity, for our U.S. dollar activity and our forthcoming sterling and euro activity, we're regulated as a financial institution because we have to address the risks of financial crime and we have to protect consumers and make sure disclosures are there and that we have the right forms of security and underlying collateral as a company and all the things that go into being an FI. Yeah.
I know we're going to have to be mindful of your time, but I want to talk about the regulatory challenges a little bit. So I know that Circle has put a tremendous priority on getting the regulation, regulatory process right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Talk about that from both the standpoint of the innovating company and the regulatory system. Do you feel that we are going to be able to nest these kinds of companies into the regulatory structure we have now, or are we going to have to change it? And, from the standpoint of a company like yours, what are the key challenges?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, again, for a company like Circle, because so much of what we do is sort of already regulated as money transmission or e-money activity, and all those rules exist, so we have to go be licensed and compliant with all that anyway. I think a lot of the digital currency stuff that's already come out in the U.S. at the federal level through FinCEN and now many states, and is now, we're going to see, I think, similar in the U.K. and Japan, basically treats companies like Circle as money transmitters and have the similar kinds of obligations. But there'll be the regulatory issues will go into people who offer derivatives, trading exchanges, people who are doing, crypto-backed equities. I'm sure the SEC will have something to say about that, et cetera, et cetera. So lots of different agencies will have a view and will have to provide guidance and or amend rules and or will need new policy to deal with all those use cases over time.
Do you worry about them being able to keep up with the change?
I do.
As a former regulator.
Yeah, I do. I think, I think back to, again, the early internet, right? The FCC regulated the airwaves, right? And anyone who wanted to broadcast, had to go get an FCC license, and it was a very cumbersome thing and complicated. And, well, that's just gone. I mean, yeah, if you want to do terrestrial broadcast, you still need to go get a license, right? And there are reasons for that. But anyone can go broadcast now. It's a global system. It just blew away all the national regulatory systems that existed for communications. They're just gone. I mean, they're just much less relevant. Mm-hmm. And I think that there'll be ways in which this technology comes into the financial world that are similar. And I'm not saying the regulatory stuff is gone, because I think there's really important issues that have to get addressed, but it's moving so fast. And it's important to let that innovation happen. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting fine line. I think definitely financial regulators ought to be hiring more technologists. Auditing firms ought to be hiring more technologists. There are a lot of industries, the fiduciary trust industries broadly defined, are going to go through a lot of change, I think, and the regulators of those industries too are going to have to adapt to that. But it does concern me because this stuff is moving very fast.
Do you have advice for if you were in a regulatory approach yourself? What do you think that they should be thinking about other than what you just said about hiring more technologists? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there something they should be focused on?
I think it's pretty straightforward in some ways. It's just getting smart. It's getting to know all the participants in the ecosystem, industry, non-governmental, etc. It's getting really educated, and that's potentially also hiring people who have different competencies in your organization. But it's also just that's part of getting educated. But it's really about getting educated. And I think there's some fantastic folks in just within the U.S. federal regulatory bodies who are way out there getting educated on this stuff. But then it's balancing that against like how big of a threat or risk. What are the real risks today? Right now, it's pretty small, right? Jennifer Shasky Calvary in her Senate testimony on the topic made it very clear. She said the money laundering risk and financial crime risk of digital currency is a couple hundred million dollar problem potentially. Right now, there's $2 trillion of U.S. dollar that's laundered and used in financial crime around the world right now. So we've got a much bigger problem out there to deal with than what's happening with digital currency. It's got its own unique challenges, and so those have to be looked at. But you always have to balance like how big of a problem is this, and when to get involved and how to get involved without stifling innovation.
Yeah, tough balance. We did a podcast with Tom Curry, the controller of the currency, who set up an innovation task force, much to their credit, and they're
very
trying
aware,
to grapple with that issue.
How
about advice to the traditional industry, banks of all sizes, as they try to think about how to get ready for all this change?
Well, I think what's been interesting, of course, in the last 12 months has been major financial institutions went from sort of being in denial to actually saying, you know what, we're going to get really smart about this. And they're, incubating ideas, they're getting accelerators with companies in the space involved. They're creating their own kind of industry consortia to go do research in these areas. So I think there's real movement there. I think it will not be that long before we start seeing traditional banks have digital currency offerings integrated into their payment products. I don't know how long that'll be, but I certainly expect that to happen because I think they're going to need to be competitive. It's sort of like the New York Times needed to have a website if they want to remain relevant 20 years ago. So everyone will eventually sort of have a way to interact with all of this. And I think we'll see in the next year or two some of those FIs have actual products that actually work with this stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have advice for other innovators in the space?
Sure. It depends on what kind of advice. With respect to regulatory or...
Well, really, actually anything, but...
Yeah, I've said this in a couple of talks I gave recently, which is that I think there's this misconception. It's a tech industry misconception, or maybe it's a Silicon Valley misconception, which is that the regulators are out to get you, or, they're standing in the way or are going to have all this onerous stuff and so on. And
they try to keep them from noticing that you exist.
Right. It's sort of the fly under the radar. Mm-hmm. It's go through the back door to figure all this stuff out. And I think it's a huge mistake. I think what I've found in the U.S. and in Europe and in Japan and in China and other places is that people are really interested in innovation, and they want to. Everyone sees this collision of the internet, technology, mobile, finance, digital currency. They see this, and they can't see the whole picture. They can see enough that they realize this is really significant. We got to figure this out. So the best course is go in through the front door and engage and educate and realize that actually a lot of folks on the regulatory and policymaking side are actually in your court. They actually want to see increased competition, better products for consumers, better economic outcomes for society. That's what they want. They're not there to, in the back pocket of the big banks. There's a lot of misconception, and I think that if you're in internet finance and you're thinking about your approach to regulatory I think it's important to really take that view.
Yeah, I'm glad I asked. Bringing it back to consumers, I know it'll take a while, but it strikes me that a lot of problems that consumers have, especially sort of the underserved, marginal, marginally attached to the banking system or the financial system, have to do with the slowness of payments. People who are living in a cash economy and relying on a payday loan or an overdraft is partly because they don't know when something's going to be in their account, this could revolutionize that.
I think you know, an app like Circle on a smartphone with a cloud-based financial service like that is, you know, for many people, I think over time can be a substitute for a bank account or traditional kind of checking account, and can provide a lot of benefits and be a really great experience that works with friends and family, works with merchants, works with other people. So I think there's ways to do that. I think one of the problems that exists is I think the internet, there are sort of two big missing pieces on the internet, in my view. One was really a set of protocols for value exchange, and I think we're starting to see that. But there's also, we don't really have a set of open protocols for identity and reputation. And there's a lot of digital identity initiatives in different countries around the world, including especially in emerging markets. And oftentimes those digital identity initiatives are merged with financial initiatives and mobile. And but I think rather than, again, more stovepipe country-specific or telco-specific kinds of things, it would be great if we had an open way to deal with that. And why that's important is that then someone can develop history. And they can be trusted through kind of cryptographic verification of their identity, and that can be really powerful for financial inclusion over time as well.
Are you optimistic that the technology will? It seems like we're in an arms race between technology being used for harm and for good in terms of cyber attacks and data security and so on. Do you think we're moving toward a more secure system overall that will work better for people, or can't we tell?
Well, I think the whole world is trying to learn a lot more around security of digital artifacts, transactions, and the like. I think, crypto computing offers some interesting scenarios to really improve that. I think we need to continue to try and build things as open as possible so that we get the benefits of that, the freedom of that, the global connectedness of that, and really resist efforts to balkanize or kind of lock off or put too many controls on things. And I think in general, the openness of the internet and its global connectedness and the ability to move information freely has had huge benefits society, culturally, economically for the world. And there have been some negatives too. But I think by and large, I think almost everyone would say the benefits have way outstripped the negatives.
Yeah. So one last question. It's a two-parter. You talked earlier about the fact that initially your liberal arts degree wasn't practical, and yet did you good in the long run? I'd love for you to talk about that, and I'd also like you to talk about how you keep up with all of this change. Maybe those are related questions, maybe they're not, but what do you do to stay up with the explosion of change around us?
So, I think my degrees definitely have been really helpful. Actually very relevant to this project because of the intersection of political, economic, and technological kind of forces, and so it's quite relevant, those interests. But I think...
Remind us what they were, the subjects again?
Oh, political science, philosophy, and economics.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think they were actually quite helpful in all of my business endeavors. I'm interested in figuring out how does technology impact society and the economy, and from a kind of macro view. So that's just informed a lot of the things that I've worked on. So I think it's been extremely relevant. In terms of keeping up, I just read a lot. Mm-hmm. Just try and read a lot and think a lot. And,
if we have listeners who are trying to figure out how they're going to ever, you know, catch up with all of this, is there anything in particular you would advise them to read?
Oh, there's so much. You know, I think there's some fantastic books that are really books about you know, kind of startups and technology and the internet and history of the internet, history of the companies that have made the internet really amazing, like, you know, Google and Amazon and Facebook and Apple and all these. I think reading about that is really a good foundation. Mm-hmm. I think I'm a huge, you know, with a lot of this stuff, like digital currency is a great example. I think there's probably, you know, 100 million people who've heard about it or have some idea of what it is, but there's, you know, only a couple million have actually ever done anything. So I think I'm a big fan of hands-on learning. So I think if you have listeners who haven't, you know, used, you know, a digital currency app or service or other things.
Sign up for Circle.
Sign up for Circle, exactly.
Yeah, I'm into that. I'm fearless. I don't always know what I'm doing, but I try things as much as I can, because you're right, that's otherwise it's all theoretical.
Yeah, that's right.
So is there anything I haven't asked you that you'd like to add? I could talk with you all day. It's been fun. Fascinating.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a good discussion. Really appreciate it.
Well, I can't thank you enough, Jeremy Allaire. Tell people where they can find Circle.
So if you go to the Google Play Store or the Apple App Store, just type Circle Pay. Search for Circle Pay. You'll find us right away. We're well-rated, good apps. Or you can go to circle.com.
Great. And we will put information about Circle and about you and about the things we've talked about on our show notes at jsbarefoot.com.
Excellent.
And I just want to thank you for being my guest today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Fascinating, isn't it? I predict you will find Jeremy's ideas staying on your mind for a long time. They have really kept me thinking ever since I talked with him. Come to our website at jsbarefoot.com for more information about Circle, Jeremy Allaire, and the topics that we discussed. And please come to make a donation so that we can keep Barefoot Innovation going. And also please write a review of the show on iTunes. And now, guess what? I have a video for you, two videos actually. You can find them at www.regulationinnovation.com. I have been working on creating this series for a very long time. Many of you know that I've been a consultant for many years, and a couple of years ago someone suggested to me that I take the kind of advice that people pay me for as a consultant and distill it into video briefings that would be accessible and affordable for a much wider market. I decided to do that and to build the series around the question of how to thrive through the top two forces that are disrupting consumer financial services, which are technology innovation and regulation. I think people will be fascinated by this, anyone interested in fintech, but it's specifically designed to be both thought-provoking and practical for financial companies that are working their way through all this disruption and trying to thrive. It's for traditional companies and innovators, and it's for the people working in them on the innovation side, the business side, and the regulatory side. There is nothing else remotely like it. So come to regulationinnovation.com, check it out, and have a little fun, because in addition to an introductory video, I made a little bonus one that answers at long last this burning question: why does Joanne Barefoot have an Xbox since she has never played a video game in her entire life? And what the heck does this have to do with financial innovation? Come to regulationinnovation.com and I will see you there.